This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Brendan Walsh, Dylan McKay, Joe Montana, your savior. Superman loves Lois Lane, Shirley Jones and God Cobain, Chelsea Clinton and Percy Slick, Robert Johnson and Ivy H, Randy Griffith and Larry Bird, Legend, Legend, Nerd, 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 Nerd.
Place to Be Nation, greetings and salutations. How are you? This is Todd Weber, and we're back with another installment of Conversation Comics. It's been a while. This is my first one in about a month or so, but I was very lucky to line up a conversation with Image Comics' Tom Coker. Tom's been working on a book with Jonathan Hickman entitled The Black Monday Murders, to be released, or was released, depending on when you're listening to this, August 10th. And so I got together with Tom. We talked about the book. And in the second half of the interview, we talked about his development as an artist and maybe kind of the history of Tom in comics. He goes back from the early 90s up till today, but has very interesting stories to tell. And names are named, so we are protecting the innocent as best we can. But we hope you enjoy it. Thank you very much for checking out this latest installment of Conversation Comics, this time with Mr. Tom Coker.
Tom, how's it going?
Not bad. How about you?
Doing very well. Did you go to San Diego Comic Con this year?
I did not. I could not get a badge. I did not verify my credentials within the last 3 years, I guess. So I have no proof that I'm professional.
Wow.
Badge.
Wow. So, were you to want to go, would you talk to Mr. Kirkman, or how would you get back in?
I just got to go through the process with San Diego, but with the Comic-Con people, but they're not the most responsive folks.
Got a lot of stuff going on. It doesn't seem to be about comics themselves.
No, and I'm kind of glad I didn't want to go. I was going to go because of the Black Monday stuff to support help support the book, but it seems like it didn't need me to support it. It doesn't need me to support it anyway. I think it's doing fine all on its own.
Speaking of Black Monday murders, what is the premise of the book, or that you can tell without spoiling anything?
I'm not as good at Hickman as this. It seems like it's about these financial groups who are actually like cabals or covens or something that are working with these nefarious dark forces to control money, which is the only real magical element that still exists in our world. And it's dark and nefarious and bloody. And
so money in the world markets are tied into the occult and magic.
Yeah, they're complete make-believe.
Cool. Is this a unique universe?
As far as not being connected to other Hickman books?
Standalone.
I think so. I mean, I've never asked him that. I don't know the question. Answer that. I don't think we're not going to do any crossovers, so we're not going to have other characters popping up. I think Hickman's done with crossovers for a while.
Yeah. Where, do you think there are any influences on the book?
As far as the writing or as far as
the theme, as far as the,
I think just a lot of what's going on in the world today with, you know, how I don't think the people who work in the financial markets do themselves any favors to make themselves look nice and cuddly and approachable. But then again, I don't know if they really even care. I mean, I don't think they really covet our favor very much. So.
Is there a protagonist?
Hickman has a lot of characters in it, and they seem to, yeah, kind of work as an ensemble. And there's, I mean, you know, it seems like people are not necessarily, I'm a villain, or I'm a good guy, or I'm a hero, or I'm a whatever. They seem like they have mixed motives and reasons for doing what they're doing. So sometimes they seem to work as good guys, and sometimes they seem to work as bad guys.
Well, this is your third Image book, yeah? As far as interiors?
Yeah. Okay.
So we had Undying Love and then The Ride. Is that the order?
Well, if you want to go back, I did Vanguard, so that's my fourth,
true.
I guess.
Yeah, that does count. Back in the original Image explosion of
back when I was 18, I think I did that book.
Okay. Your art has changed a tremendous amount.
Yeah. Hopefully, yeah. No, I did, I've done The Ride stuff, which was super fun, because I get to write all that stuff, and it was all printed in black and white, which is super, super fun.
Yeah, your stuff lends itself well to black and white.
Yeah, I don't seem to get along well with color, but, and then, yeah, Undying Love, which is colored really beautifully by Daniel Friedman, and then this one, yeah, this is the, so this would be the third book in my modern era.
Very good. Does a lot of it take place in Wall Street, or does it go deeper than that, further than that, like Europe?
We have three timelines right now. And I'm going to stay kind of vague because I don't know what Hickman wants, Jonathan's going to be okay with me giving away or not. So, but we have three timelines. One is the crash in 29. We have that as one story that's happening, and then we have a story that takes place in Berlin in 89 at the wall during that, you know, around the time of that dissolving, and there was a subsequent crash right then too, I think, right? And then the one happening now is about the current recession or. Right, what are they calling it? Recession?
Yeah,
is that what it is?
I guess so, yeah.
Depression was the Great Depression, and then 2009 was, yeah. 2008 or whatever was the recession.
Yeah, it was 2008.
And so we have three timelines going on, and we have a lot of the same characters in all three timelines, which is a bitch to draw because I'm not 100% sure how to, like, make them all, how you're supposed to know that one person 20 years ago is the same person now. Without,
hopefully,
like, giving him, like, a silly scar or something.
Yeah.
Like, doing a cable thing where you give him a metal arm. But it takes place all over the place. And I've drawn scenes in, a lot of scenes in Manhattan and on Wall Street. And there's a, you know, there's a police, or there's a investigative element and stuff like that. So there's a lot going on.
Will each issue feature all three timelines? Or does it do, like, one per book?
No, it's done. Every issue right now is featured more than one timeline per book. Like the one I'm doing right now, the first issue had two timelines. It had the 1920s and the and now, and then the second issue has Berlin and now, and then the third issue has, I think that might be the only one that only features one timeline, which is now. And then the fourth issue has three or four timelines. Like, there's a couple timelines in there that aren't... I don't know how much we're going to repeat them, but it's combining all three timelines in the fourth issue right now.
Okay, cool. What's the expected run?
Depending on support from fans so that we can keep doing it and afford to do it, it should be... We want to do 12 issues.
Cool. So maybe fill two trades?
It's huge. It's like every issue is 56 pages.
Yeah, so that's like, they're almost trades in themselves.
Yeah, like after the first four issues, we're going to have, 230 pages, plus we're going to have all the extras you put in trades, so it's going to be a 300-page book, the first trade.
That's cool, yeah. That'll be
four issues. We're talking 1,000 pages by the time we're done with 12.
Image is crazy with the trades, because, I mean, you'll come out with the last issue, and it'll show up in the trade very next week sometimes. You really want to get those trades, and they sometimes price them a little bit. The first one, very competitively, to get the trade only people to jump on. I know, like Snyder Switches is very. You can find the price of the initial issues. The first trade is less than half the price of what you would do.
Really?
Yeah, it's like $8 for the first trade.
That's not smart.
Yeah.
I mean, in a sense, that really hurts the monthly, the floppy sales, I'd imagine. I know we're going to do an oversized trade. That'll be, you know, that'll collect. I can't really speak to exactly what Jonathan wants to do. I know I've been trying to push for doing an oversized black and white trade that would have.
Yeah.
That would be mainly art centric. And it would, because I mean, Jonathan's doing, not to exclude Jonathan from that, because Jonathan's doing all the design stuff and he's doing all the, like each book is around between 30 and 36 pages of art. I think the second issue is the only one that goes up to like 40 something pages of art.
And then there are text only pages?
And then there's a lot of supplemental stuff like dossiers and that sort of Alan Moore type thing where you have the dossiers and you have newspaper articles and you have police reports and internal company memos and shit like that. That's all throughout the book.
Cool. It's going to be a very dense read. Things.
That's the word that Jonathan and I use all the time. Like he's saying that he wants this to be the densest book I know that he's ever produced. And for me, it's definitely the densest book I've ever produced. Like there's no, I mean, I don't know how familiar anybody is that's listening to this with what I do, but usually there's a lot of like, splatter and razor blade cuts and stuff all over the pages. And I do a lot of scribbles and stuff like that. And, that stuff has really had to take a back seat in these books because there's no room for it. So every panel, you know, there's something specific happening. And so I can't design these pages that have these open spaces where I can, make use of that kind of stuff. And so it becomes, the book is dense. Like it's been a slow, incredibly hard, incredibly painstaking. But in the end, I think it's really rewarding. I think the book looks like Jonathan and I really coordinated what we were doing to try and make something that was really cohesive.
Cool. Yeah, I like the imagery of the cover is very striking with the goat's head.
Mm. Yeah, that is, I was going to say, I think that's one of the bad guys in the future, but I don't know that's true for 100%. But I'm positive. I know that is one of the bad guys because that's why Jonathan sent me a bunch of reference on what he wanted the bad guy to look like. But he has not shown up yet. I haven't got to draw him other than that yet.
That's cool. So, yeah, you have that to look forward to.
I think there's a lot to look forward to. I mean, as far as, like, I'm done with 4 issues. In a couple of, like, another month, I'll be done with the 4th issue. And it really feels like the story is just getting going. Like, it feels like the story is, like, really, like, by the end of the 4th issue, you feel like you're, or I felt like I was, like, all the titillation or the lead up seems like it's all paid off into this really great jumping off point that I don't know what the break is going to be between issue or between arcs. We're doing 4 issues and then we're taking a break to catch up and we're going to do 4 more issues and then take a break to catch up and 4 more issues, whatever. And I feel like people are going to be really happy, especially if you like what Hickman does and you like what I do, if you can put the two of those together.
So this was a book that he had, that he created first and then hired you on. So you don't have ownership on it, right?
No, I have, I'm not an owner. I don't think I'm even listed as a creator on this. It's work for hire. And we've talked about what to do after this. And so we've talked about creating something new together after these 12 are done, which right now feels like a lifetime away from now, but for both of us. But yeah, for this one, I'm just work for hire.
Cool. With pages, are there dialogue on pages, or is the artwork going to kind of speak for itself? As like a, are you doing one page splashes for everything, or are there panels?
In the book, everything's panels. I don't think Hickman has written a splash page or a double page spread yet. So what I have to do is read the script and then decide, like, okay, this would be a good place for a for a breath, and so I'll add a splash page for a, you know, emphasis on a moment or something. But so I'm adding a splash page, or I mean, splash pages and double page spreads to every book.
But whether or not, but he's not writing them, so it's nice because he kind of gives me the freedom to decide where those things need to live. And so I think I've been able to get one or two in every book, I mean, splash page or I think it was a double page spread in every issue so far. But they're still multi-panel double page spreads. They're not single images, which I like doing more anyway. I like being able to break it up with the panels because it gives me the ability to inset images and stuff. Hi, Becky. This is my dog, Becky. You can't see her, but she's a goofball. Hello, Becky.
And the splash pages are just fun, too, because they're splash pages. So.
Yeah. Are you doing everything digitally?
It's about, I imagine it's about 80% digital. Like I do all my roughs by hand, you know, on paper, with my little crimson pencil. And, I do those about a quarter size, I guess. And then, I scan those and then work those up into pages.
That's cool. So, yeah, I saw your digital workstation. It's really neat.
It's pretty archaic now. I see other guys, what they're doing, and I'm just like, it looks like they're working in a science fiction movie, and I have a 10-year-old Cintiq pad and a 6-year-old iMac, and I'm getting to the point where I understand how to do it. Like, I can, it took a good year to figure out exactly how to get back to what I do doing it digitally. Like, it didn't, it took a long time to fit, because with the digital stuff, you can be so exacting, and you can blow stuff up to, you know, 500 times it's the size it's going to print. And then when you do that, you can see all these little teeny mistakes here's a little dot of ink that shouldn't be there or whatever. And you can really get lost in these really, really super pointless exercises of trying to make stuff perfect.
Yeah, and then it shrunk down to comic size,
and
you won't see it at all.
You can't see it anyway. It just becomes a little blob. Yeah. I mean, I remember doing the first book I did totally digitally was an Avengers annual for Marvel that I wasn't able to actually finish because of just running into this problem where I was literally spending you know, an extra day per page just sitting there doing all this ridiculous touch-ups and changes and trying to make things more, you know, perfect. And then realizing when I'd get done, I'd print a page to see what it looks like, you know, so I would print them at size and realize it just turns into mud. Like, it's so small when it's done that it doesn't matter. And then I look at a bunch of, yesterday I was looking at a bunch of, I'm a big Mark Silvestri fan. I think Mark Silvestri is like, I know he's highly thought of, but I still think he's one of the most underrated,
yeah, I would say he's underrated
artists that have worked in the last 50 years. I think he's just that good. And I was looking at a bunch of his old Conan work because I remember being a fan of his stuff on King Conan. When I was a kid, I loved King Conan. He did 15 issues of that or 10 issues of that or something. And I was looking at his pages online, and I was just like, fuck, like, excuse my French, but
no,
I was just like, oh yeah, this is how you're supposed to draw a page. Like, you're not supposed to sit here and fret over every aspect of it. Just get it on the paper and let the combination of the words and the pictures do the job. And that's a hard thing for me working digitally. That's a hard thing to keep in focus.
His kind of his area of the image world is he does the like Dark Child and
lots of babes and bikinis and
lots
stuff.
Of it and metal bikinis,
yeah, metal
and video
bikinis,
games
yeah.
too. I mean, his stuff is done licensed pretty well, but he seems to be pretty happy just doing that.
I know he's working on a new secret project that I keep seeing little bits and pieces of here and there on Facebook, and it's interesting because it's like I know he's gotten. Like, when I first really became a huge fan of Mark's stuff, I say it like I know him. I don't know Mark Silvestri. I met him once back when he was still doing X-Men at a convention at the Cow Palace in the Bay Area. But when I first saw his stuff, he was doing, I guess he did the Cloak and Dagger fill-in was the first thing I really was like, oh, like I know who Mark Silvestri is now. Even though I'd read the King Conan stuff, I didn't, I was more amazed by just the stories and amazed by like Kaluta's covers for those things were so awesome. And then, but when he was doing X-Men and he was working with Dan Green was inking his stuff, I think mm-hmm. it was.
Yeah, he was kind of the primary inker for that long run, the Siege Perilous, you know, yeah. Australia, Outback X-Men.
Oh, so good.
Yeah.
All Jubilee and all those guys. But then, and I know after that he did the Wolverine stuff and he became more, his work kind of transformed from being like the John Buscema look of stuff, you know, in that school to being more, you know, hyper detailed, really kinetic, like motion oriented stuff, yeah. which is, I mean, Buscema and that stuff is still that he, Silvestri has always been able to convey an amazing amount of weight and motion and power of what he does more than I think almost anybody, I think, except for maybe like a Gene Colan or someone like that. But the new stuff he's doing, it has all that same like weight and power and motion, but then there's like this really beautiful and finely refined, like kind of Franklin Booth kind of thing going on, which is weird, a weird combination. I would never have imagined that combination because his work is so expressive and Franklin Booth's work is expressive, but it's also hyper. There's a lot of motion in what Franklin Booth does. And I mean, you know, Franklin Booth, he's an illustrator from the olden times. And he's the guy that basically like Bernie Wrightson absorbed when he was doing like a Frankenstein stuff and that, like those really hyper lines, no outlines, that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. And there's so much motion and power in that stuff, but it's just a different type of motion and power. And to see Silvestri combine that with what he was already doing, it's like, it looks like John Buscema, if he were an illustrator in the 1890s or something. Like it's amazingly effective. And I don't mean to compare Mark to these guys and say he's just being influenced, I think, more than anything. But it's a nice thing to see.
Do you see any of your earlier style still in your current work? Like does it feel the same?
It depends on where my earlier style starts or ends. Like, I mean, Blood and Water at this point is 15 years ago.
Yeah, around the millennium.
I mean, I guess it's 13 years ago because Susie and I were living together at that point. But, I mean, that stuff was 2000. Oh, no, I hadn't finished it when we got married. So that was 2000. No, I didn't finish it before we left. Remember, because I came back and had to finish half an issue. Yeah. We went off and got married in Italy, and we were gone for like 5 weeks, and I remember having to call my editor a few months ahead of time. We had so many problems with editors, and I'd been a big pain in the ass on that book. And
was it Alonzo, or who was working on that back then?
No, it started out with Kevin Bedard. I think he became a writer at CrossGen, and now I think he's writing or editing some... I don't know where he's at now. I met Judd because my wife, Susanna's roommate, Stacy, at the time, was Judd's cousin. And we went up to APE in, is it APE in San Francisco?
Yes. The Alternative Press.
Yeah. And I met Judd there because we all went up together and Judd was there. And Judd had no idea who I was. I didn't know who he was.
You didn't watch Real World?
So no, the only real I watched was because I worked at Wildstorm. I watched one with Sarah. Sarah Becker, because no one knows who Sarah Becker is anymore. She was a celebrity because she was a blonde girl with nice legs that worked on comics, and she was funny as all shit. And just the super outgoing, wonderful person. But and she got on The Real World, and Jim, she worked at Wildstorm. She was an editor at Wildstorm. And Jim would just send her care packages filled with Wildstorm promotional material just for her to plaster the walls in her... whatever the room she was in, they were in Miami, I think. But
Over and onto the TV show. That's very cool.
Yeah, so her room, you'd go into her room and it was just every week, it was just all new posters and books for Wildstorm. She wore, you know, comic book t-shirts for the guys and stuff like that. I loved her. She was a wonderful person. Or she is a wonderful person. I saw her not too long ago, I guess, 4 or 5 years
Jim
ago.
Jim just keeps getting bigger and bigger, though.
He deserves every bit of it.
Absolutely.
Jim is a genius. Like, I don't know how...
He's a lot of our favorite artists. You know? Not necessarily mine, but I respect him, and I look at him as, like, the guy that kind of didn't make art into rock star kind of status.
That was Rob Liefeld, actually.
Yeah. Levi commercials.
Yeah, Levi commercial changed everything.
Yeah. Well, and Rob's had
some... I remember seeing that and just being blown away to see a comic book guy. I knew who he was at the time, and I was just like, man, this guy's on TV and people are talking about it and it's important.
Yeah.
But Jim, I don't think anybody can overstate the value that Jim has had, that Jim Lee has added to comic books. Like, he is, he's an amazing illustrator. I don't know how he does it. His work is,
he's been very consistent.
And his work is just its own thing. Like, I know a lot of people try and imitate what Jim does, and a lot of people try to... I mean, even me, when I was younger, trying to get into the business, like, that was the thing people said. They said, if you can imitate Jim Lee, Rob Liefeld, Eric Larson, Todd McFarlane, any of these guys, then we'll give you work. And so I just did my worst version, or I did my best version, which is one of the worst versions of those guys, and it gets you work. But no one can do what Jim does. And he's also just a really... He's a stand-up guy, and he's an honest guy, and I've never had a negative dealing with him. And even when we might have had a dealing through Wildstorm, like a business thing that might have been a little weird, Jim was always, and it wouldn't involve him directly, but it might be something with editorial or with whatever it might be. Jim was always the first one on the phone to make sure that
that's pretty awesome.
Things were fixed and you were happy. And this is a guy who didn't need to call me. Like, yeah. He didn't need to know who I was, but he was always incredibly generous with his time and with his input into what you were doing. I remember doing, I did a book called Gen 13 Max. It was a crossover for Wildstorm back in 96, I think. And I sat there in the bullpen at Wildstorm and drew a lot of it. And Jim would come out every couple hours and he would come over and look over your shoulder and just be the most complimentary, friendly. And he was really genuinely like, excited to see what other people were doing. And he didn't have to be. Like, he was already the biggest, as big as you could possibly be in this business at that point. He didn't need to be nice to me. And he was. And there's been plenty of professionals I've met that were not nice.
Yeah.
And they had no reason to be dicks because they weren't Jim Lee. But so as far as my old style or the stuff I used to do when I was a kid, I don't see any of that anymore. I still see, but as far as like, I think of I did a bunch of that shit or that work, you know, when I was younger. And then I quit for a while because I just didn't know how to draw. And I spent a long time trying to learn how to draw, a couple years. And then I came back and did some books. I mean, I've never been a real prolific comic book guy, but I ended up going off and drawing, doing toy design and some TV and film stuff and design work for 4 or 5 years, I think, or 6 years. And it was just me doing conceptual work. And so... That was all right before Blood and Water, I think.
Storyboards and things? And
a lot of it was toy design. So they would call me up and say, like, I did a lot of work for Hasbro. And so they would say, we're doing, you know, spiders meet, or they'd do, like, insects meet, gladiator type, you know, gonzo gladiator type Roman game stuff. Go. And I would just then go, okay. And I'd have to make up, you know, 20 versions of that every day
angle,
for,
every...
No, I was doing conceptual. So I would just do sketches and then they would say yay or nay. And if they liked one, then I would develop that one more, but I'd have to do 20 a day for, you know, they'd say, oh, we want you for 5 days or 6 days or whatever. And so you just sit there and do little sketches of these guys or, you know, 8.5 by 11 sketches of these guys for the whole day. And I learned how to draw during that period because I wasn't doing comics and, I'm a huge fan of comics and the work that people have done in the past. And so when I was working in comics, I was really beholden to comics. Like, I don't know how to say that.
No,
I'm working in that world, and so I'm focusing on just doing that, you know, and as soon as I got out of that, I wasn't doing that anymore. I just started doing whatever I wanted to do, so I didn't have to think about whether someone's going to ink it or whether someone's going to color it or whether someone's going to, a fan's going to think it's got enough speed lines or whatever, or if I'm putting enough, you know, black in it or something, and so I did that for a long, like, 4 or 5 years there, and then by the time that was done, I realized that how I drew it completely developed into something totally different. And so when I came back, I did Blood and Water. I mean, I think what I'm doing now is very different from Blood and Water, but I think if you look at it as a whole from Blood and Water till now, I think it all looks like a body of just developing work. I'm not as obviously designy as I was during Blood and Water, those pages, but I think the stuff I'm doing now is just more subtly designy. I'm a big fan of storytelling. It's the only thing I do that's really that I think I'm really good at.
Yeah.
And so
you still think like Mazzucchelli is the storytelling guy?
Mazzucchelli's a god.
Yeah.
I think he's just that run of Daredevil and the year one, mm-hmm.
Then I like the stuff that's come out lately too.
The Astro polyp. Mm-hmm. I think it's beautiful.
Exterior
I have it just sitting right over there somewhere.
Oh, okay, right on. Yeah, that one blew me away when I saw it. Like, okay, he's still there. That's still the guy.
I think his work is beautiful. I just think now it's a little bit more. It's a little bit more the New Yorker than it is, Daredevil. But I think it's stunning work to look at. And I think between him and Mignola and, you know, guys like the Jim Lee guys, and I still think about all those Jim Lee, Silvestri guys, I still think about them every few pages. I'll do something and I'll think, oh, that's still a Jim Lee thing, or that's still a Silvestri thing, or an Eric Larson thing, or it's a Dave Mazzucchelli thing, or it's you know, whatever. I still think about those guys, and Archie Goodwin, I think about a lot anyway. But like Al Williamson and Jorge Zaffino and those various guys that were just, they all had these moments where they brought something completely new to the game, and I think everybody in the business drew from them.
Yeah.
Art Adams, too. I mean, I still think about Art Adams all the time.
I'm glad he's still working, too.
He should be. He's unbelievably good. He's doing a Game of Thrones thing now, right?
I don't know. I haven't seen... I've seen just in previews that he's covered by Art Adams. He still gets a lot of work there, but I don't know what he's doing as far as interiors.
I don't know if it's an interior. I saw a prelim, I think, for a Game of Thrones, like, wraparound or something. Or maybe it was a cover where you piece it together or something. I don't know, but it was... And it was Art Adams still being able to draw more shit and make it clear and easy to look at, mm-hmm. than anybody else has ever been able to do.
Yeah.
I don't know how...
So much detail.
But he's smart about it. Like, he doesn't draw... Like, I get tired when I'm drawing detail, and I just, my brain starts to fuzz out, and I can tell, like, you know, the scales on the snake look really great at the beginning, and then by the end of it, they're like, looks like I've fallen asleep or given it to my kid to finish. And Art Adams is just able to always, never tire out. I don't know how he does it.
Yeah, I remember just reading his X-Men Asgardian stuff. That's, to me, is the pinnacle for me.
Yeah.
It was... characters I loved, and an amazing story, and getting to draw Asgard, and
that stuff is,
he's got a unique anatomy, you know, he draws those quads really long, but.
Yeah. Well, also I know the first one he had Terry Austin inked him, and then, but then on the second one he had a whole slew of inkers, and he inked some of them himself, but he had like Wolf Portasio inked, mm-hmm. some of those pages and various other people. And they really brought something to that work, and I'm sure he was just developing at what he did. They're stunning to look at, and even his later, like the Fantastic Four stuff. I think my favorite he did was that X-Men annual he did after all the Asgard stuff was wrapped up. He did the one with Longshot and Rogue and all those characters, and he just drew those people. Right.
Was that coming, that came out long before you, or a little bit before you started drawing or before you started getting into comics, right? So that was...
No, that stuff was all like my... God, I don't know. I remember buying all the X-Men and all the classic X-Men covers, and they had the Art Adams covers and the John Bolton backup stories. And
yeah, those are great.
Yeah, they're wonderful. And then I remember getting out of comics just because, you know, suddenly girls were more important and other things in life were taking over. And I remember when I was about 15, I guess, I hadn't been buying comics in a couple of years, or steadily at least. I'd been maybe looking at them but not buying them. I remember Jim Lee was doing Punisher, and there was an issue of the Punisher where he, or maybe a few issues, but where he was teamed, or initially he was fighting against, but then teamed up with the Black Widow. And the cover was this, I think it was a red cover with a giant Black Widow on a web and Frank Castle stuck in the web with the spider closing in on him that Jim Lee did. I saw that on a spinner rack at a 7-Eleven, and prior to that, I mean, I read a lot of independent books. I read a lot of creepy magazine, and there was plenty of, you know, Marvel stuff, but Savage Sword of Conan was my favorite book, and creepy magazine I still think is the best book ever done. But then I saw that cover and I looked at it and I was like, oh my God, this is not comic. These are different. Something's changed in comics. And so I started buying that Punisher run with Jim Lee, and then was able to, you know, I found the Todd McFarlane Spider-Man stuff started maybe a year after that, I think, mm-hmm. and he was on the Hulk at that point.
Yeah, this was in high school for me, so like 88, or the 87, 88, when those McFarlane blew up with Spidey.
Yeah, 298?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have 300.
I have all of those.
I tracked down a nice copy of 300,
and I got rid of most of my books, so I think I still have all those. I have all the Jim Lee stuff still and all the Art Adams and everything. But then I got back into that, and then I looked up all the guys I'd been looking at before. Like, I'd been a big fan of Mignola on Rocket Raccoon and Cloak and Dagger stuff he had done and various other, like the Elric stuff.
You do the Batman Elseworlds he did?
Those are a lot later, though. That's like a decade later, I think.
Yeah,
Rocket they were 8 or 9 years.
I mean, I remember.
Because right around...
Rocket Raccoon and Longshot were coming out about the same time.
And right around the time I got into comics again, like maybe a year after that, where I was really like officially like, okay, I'm going to do comics now for a living. I was trying to figure that out. I think it's when Cosmic Odyssey hit. So you had like Cosmic Odyssey, Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser, a couple of like graphic novels for like Doctor Strange, Doctor Doom book and stuff like that. But then you also had guys like Larry Stroman and... Yeah. Rick Leonardi and these guys, like there was a group, it was before everything coalesced into being essentially those guys who later became Image doing everything. Mm-hmm. Like there was this group of people, including those guys, but including Rick Leonardi and Brett Blevins and Sienkiewicz was still really active. All these guys, Walt Simonson was still drawing books regularly, doing X-Factor, I think.
Right? Yeah, I think so. Yeah, he
Fantastic
a,
Four, maybe.
Fantastic Four for a long time, but yeah, I mean, it was the pre-Image days. We can think about that, you know.
It was before those guys had become the driving force in all of comics, where they were drawing just everything. You know, or Byrne, if they weren't, everything had to look like that. Byrne was doing
West Coast Avengers.
What was this? It was after Superman, I guess, yeah. Right? And before Next Men. And God, they just. It was an amazing moment in comics.
Yeah, that whole late 80s, Dark Knight, Watchmen, but everything. Miracle Man, too.
Yeah, yeah, Miracle Man, you had Akira. You had all these things coming from all of... Like, that was when the first real manga, like, you had Akira. You had, like, all the Ghost in the Shell stuff was coming. All all these books that were just... Everything was different. Mm-hmm. Everything wasn't homogenized.
Yeah.
At that point. And all of us kids, like me and everybody else that came along right after that, did our very best to homogenize it as much as possible because we liked that stuff so much. We all abandoned anything we knew how to do on our own and just decided to learn how to crosshatch or do speed lines. And I was never good at that, so.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll maybe pull back the curtain and explain how I was able to get this interview.
Oh, it's not that difficult, but yes, we have history. So
yeah, we'll talk about the storied and sometimes embarrassing personal history of Tom Coker with Todd Weber when we return.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you're subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Just head to iTunes today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be podcast feed, the PWO-PTBN feed, PTBN Pop, and of course, the Kevin Kelly Show feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Some really great stuff. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. Thanks for being a fan of professional wrestling. More importantly, thanks for being a fan and supporter of the Place to Be Nation.
Place to Be Nation is JT Rizzuto here. In addition to the archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be podcast feed, you can check out Scott Friscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Mission Indie Possible, in our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. Relive Wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. All of this in addition to Scott Keith's Podcast of Doom, which includes discussions on questions from listeners as well as current day and old school wrestling. We also have sports covered too with the Sports Lounge, the TJ McClune Show, and NBA Team Podcast. On our brand new PTB Pop podcast feed, we offer great shows such as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both feeds on iTunes and be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to check out on the right-hand side of the site for details on how to support the site when you shop at Amazon and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the pro wrestling only Place to Be Nation podcast network. That's the PWO PTBN podcast network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the reaction shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We've got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
On the other hand, I want to be loved and accepted by all facets of society and not be this loudmouthed, lunatic poet musician.
Never met you face to face. I could never take your place. The silence offers more than. If you were here, you'd understand. You will want for nothing. You alone I can trust. You are not just an object to obscure with years of dust. Another NDO. And then alone, pretending that it's.
Okay, we're back with Tom Coker, Place to Be Nation. Tom Coker and I actually have a history. We have known each other for some time, so we're going to talk about our history and how that overlaps and interweaves with his work in comics. So it'll be kind of a chronological story, if you will indulge me and him. So Tom, what's your first exposure to comics / superheroes? Was it like Super Friends, or did you actually see comic books, funny books first?
Superheroes, I mean, yeah, Super Friends and like the those old Kirby Marvel animated things.
Yeah. Best theme songs ever.
Yes. And some of the stuff like Electro and Dino Girl were superheroes, but they were, you know, the
Croft Super Show on Afternoons after school. I remember that. Dr. Shrieker.
Yeah, exactly. And, but I mean, my first comic exposure was, I mean, once you got past like the Mickey Mouse and the Donald Duck comics and like all the Gold Key stuff when I was a kid, was Creepy Magazine, because it was back in the day of spinner racks, and they sold Creepy and Eerie magazine at you know every liquor store, every 7-Eleven or whatever, and I remember, I think they were 75 cents or 65 cents when comics were 45 cents, and so for 20 cents more I could get 30 more pages, and it was bigger and it was scary and creepy.
Yeah, just gravitated toward that stuff. I was a superhero guy. Were you in South Sacramento as a kid?
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. I mean, my real comic thing started because we traveled a lot around the country when I was a kid, and we had a Winnebago or a motorhome or whatever. Big 20-foot long beast. And so we would spend a whole summer driving around the country in those things, and so I would have my pencils and paper and crayons and markers, and then I'd have, you know, a stack of comics I'd take with me, or how to draw, like all the Jack Ham how to draw books, or all the not the guy from Mad Men, that's Jack Ham, right?
No, John Ham.
John Ham, okay, so Jack Ham, I think, is the name of the guy who did the how to draw books, like how to draw animals and how to draw cars and whatever. And then there was another guy, Lee Ames, I think, who did like how to draw 50 monsters. And so we would take those and hit the road, and I would just sit there bored. So I would just draw. And then we would stop every day in a new port or, of call, and I would get to go buy some comic books for the next stretch of the road. And so that's how I got into superheroes, was buying Junior Justice League, is that right? Or what is the, with like the little, oh crud, it was like Superboy, the little green guy, Magnetic Boy,
Oh, you're thinking Legion of Superheroes.
But is it, there was a kid's version, I mean not a kid's version, but there was like ones where they were like, they were teenagers, they weren't full grown. It was like those characters, but all done as teens.
No, I don't know. I mean, it sounds like Legion or Superboy in the Legion of Superheroes.
That's probably what it was, but they just weren't grown-ups. Like, there was no Batman.
Can you think of the artists at all?
In my mind, it all looks like Kurt Swan, but I can't. I don't know if it was or not. I don't know who drew it. God, what was the name of that stuff?
This seems like a blind spot.
I remember, because I watched Teen Titans now with my daughter sometimes, and there's a couple, like there's a green character on that.
Well, that's Beast Boy.
So then whatever that character,
Changeling in the new Teen Titans with, they had Robin, and that was George Perez, Marv Wolfman.
They had a version of that kid, and but it was long before Perez, or I think it was a version of him, but it was like a Martian boy maybe, and some kid that did magnetic shit, and a couple of girl characters, and Superboy.
I think you're making this up.
I probably am. It's probably like a fever dream from having the measles or something as a child. But I remember that book for...
Okay, I'll have to check that out.
I remember looking at that book and drawing those pictures until I couldn't draw anymore. Because they were just so... I don't know if it was Kurt Swan, but it was someone with that kind of like line where it was just a beautiful, like simple... And they were kids, and so I, you know... And then after that, it was all spinner racks, and it was junior high. And junior high, I remember, was when everything I drew was just basically Iron Maiden covers and and monsters and half naked ladies. I mean, that was when,
yeah,
that was when being and having the excuse that I'm drawing, damn it, I can draw naked ladies and get away with it.
Yeah, and the music video culture was so strong too.
Yeah, well, and also at that time, it was like a lot. I got a lot of Mambo Day, like all the Cheech Wizard stuff and the Kobold stuff and.
Did you get heavy metal?
I did. I got. Were you in South Sac at that period?
Not until college.
Okay. I got a. There was the Hollywood market was this really great market that had. I remember they had all these. The owner was a big fisherman, and so he had all these massive fish he'd caught that were taxidermied on the wall. And I would just go stare at him because they were so. And my dad had bought me comics forever when we go to the store. And so one day I went to the store, and there was a heavy metal. I'd never seen heavy metal. I'd seen parts of the movie
right
at that point, but I'd never seen the comic or the magazine. The
movie was pretty consistently at midnight movies.
Yeah. You know, so. I did those for years.
Yeah, with Rocky Horror.
Yeah, and the Holy Grail.
Yeah.
And the Wall.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah, I remember The Wall. I don't remember Monty Python being on that. Yeah. That's a good fit, though.
And I remember I got this issue of Heavy Metal, and it was Rand Xerox, I think, was in it, and a bunch of that kind of stuff, and suddenly there were, like, boobs. And I remember there were, like, it was, like, this alien foreign world type story, and there was this one, like, really hot chick that had four boobs. Like, man, she's super hot and, like, all dominatrixy, but she has four boobs, and they're all showing. But then it came pretty standard Marvel. I was never a big DC person until Dark Knight and Crisis. Although I bought Atari Force.
Yeah.
I loved Atari Force.
I did, too. Dude, Garcia Lopez.
Oh, he's a fucking
that's
genius.
That's one of my favorite artists, and I didn't know it until, like, I just thought he was a guy who did kind of random who's who and things like that, and that he drew one of my first comics, which is an oversized, you know, Treasury edition Superman Wonder Woman, which look at that.
Oh, I remember
gorgeous.
Those, yeah.
It's beautiful.
I had the Muhammad Ali Superman, uh-huh. The
that's
Neil
the
Adams one.
Yeah. I got to talk to him about that book. It was pretty cool.
So I liked Atari Force, but then I guess after all that stuff, it kind of just became the standard Marvel, you know, mm-hmm. New Mutants.
Yeah.
And
how early were you reading New Mutants?
I read New Mutants from the beginning. Because I remember the ads.
Yeah.
I remember the ads for... with the Sienkiewicz, like, it was really dark silhouettes, and it was like they're coming, or things are changing, or
So you remember you jumped in after, or Bill went on the book.
Yeah, it was when Bill went on the book. Yeah, so what before that it was Blevins. Is that who was doing it?
I think
Blevins came afterward.
Yeah, it was one of those guys with just like a kind of Joe Normal name. I forget his name, not Bob Hall, but something like that.
Yeah,
and I was reading it just a little bit because I was X-Men at that point, but New Mutants, here's X-Men who are my age.
Yeah,
and so right before Sienkiewicz was on the book, I'd picked it up, and then he did one cover before he started drawing or doing interiors, and it just blew me away as Cannonball across, you know, plain orange, plain red, and then boom, I think it was red, it could have been pink, but, and like that's really neat. And he's doing the knife, the razor blade work,
that stuff that I tried to rip off my entire life.
Media. I mean, he was doing it 30 years ago.
Yeah, but the illustrators he was ripping off were doing it 30 years before him, so it's not like he was breaking a lot of ground.
Yeah.
But he wasn't comics. He was making people's heads spin. But, I mean, yeah, and then the black and white boom hit. Like, you know, he had a lot of... he had Epic hit at that point. He had... And this all predated Vertigo and Image by years, but you had Pacific Comics. You had Vertigo. I mean, you had Epic, which is the Marvel stuff. You had... Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles were hitting at that point.
Yeah.
And this is all like junior high, I think. And for me, like I never was a huge superhero guy until the art forced me to become a superhero guy. You know, so like I was suddenly like, and then also the books were really good. Like the Claremont was an amazing writer, and he made books that seemed like they had a lot of gravity behind them, and they had these huge... The one drawback to a lot of the stuff I like the Creepies or the Savage Sword or Conan's or those kind of books, is they were start and stop stories. Like they didn't have a big scope. They didn't have scale, and that's what I've
done in one.
Yeah,
I like as a kid even House of Mystery and House of Secrets, that kind of stuff. The horror anthologies, I like that a lot.
But that was what I got from I think mainly from Claremont, was that suddenly these stories could go on for years, and, and you would forget something, and then it would come back and have repercussions like 2 years later, or from
Alien Legion. Well, I remember, not Starlin, but...
Frank Sirocco did it, and the writer wasn't James DeMatteis, was it? It wasn't...
Let's see.
Was it Archie Goodwin? I think he edited it.
Yeah, I mean, Archie was Mr. Epic.
Archie's the greatest editor. The greatest, he's one of the greatest personality. We talked about him yesterday, but...
Could have been Carl Potts. Alan Zelentz.
Alan Zelentz.
Okay.
Carl Potts was the, I think, editor. Was the editor on it. Yeah.
Him and Anna. I remember that name all over the bullpen bulletins.
Carl?
Yeah.
Carl's a really good guy. He's a smart son of a bitch.
Is he still an executive at Marvel or anything?
No, I think he's doing freelance editing. He's the guy who shepherded, you know, Jim Lee and all those guys into the fold. But I remember when I was a kid, probably 15 or 16, showing my portfolio to Carl Potts back when you could still do that. Got shows. And he was explaining to me the rules of direction, like how you can have characters need to look a certain way if they're going, like if they're a protagonist, they need to be facing a certain direction. If they're the antagonist, they need to be facing a certain direction, and their actions have to move in a certain way to convey, like, moving into the future and all this, you know, the story's progressing, so you move left to right. And it was this really long explanation where I had just completely botched it repeatedly on these pages I had done. And he does this whole huge explanation. He's talking about diagonals and all these different things you could do for moving the eye. But mainly he's talking about the story progresses into the future. And so your storytelling has to move left to right because that conveys moving into the future. But then he stopped and he's like, wait. That if you're drawing a story about discovery, though, that doesn't apply. It has to move right to left because that's the direction the expansion into the new world occurred.
Jeez.
And I was like,
whoa,
dude, like you can't suddenly drop like Magellan and Christopher Columbus into Portuguese, you know, explorers into the fucking conversation about comic book storytelling.
I'm still drawing,
think about that. I'm still like, God damn, like if you ever draw a wagon train, if you draw it going right to left instead of left to right.
And it's all the subliminal stuff, you know, you read. And
it's east to west.
It takes upon. Speaking of Jonathan Hickman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was. I still think about that sometimes. I saw Carl. We chatted a while 5-6 years ago, and I mentioned that to him. He's like, "It's totally true."
That's awesome. That's great. You were able to just get FaceTime with an editor back then.
It was the best thing ever. Like you had.
Was that at a convention or?
We had WonderCon up north, in Oakland.
Oakland, yeah.
And then in the Bay Area later in the city, and then we had. I would go to San Diego. I think I went 3 years before I was working, but then I still went. Every year and would talk to the editors, and you'd have every publisher was there of note, and even a lot that weren't of note, and they would bring every group editor and every managing editor and every, you know, anybody who mattered as an editor would come out to the show.
Yeah.
And they would just line these tables, and for the most part, people didn't care because it was all about comics at that point, and so all they wanted to do was come up and ask questions about, you know, like...
Who's stronger?
Yeah, exactly. You know, who would win in a fight, Superman or Mighty Mouse? And there were a lot of portfolios floating around, but it was, you know, it was not like it is today. Or maybe not today, but like it was 5-6 years ago. And so I would just walk up to... I mean, I was 15 years old, and I'm talking to Archie Goodwin and Neil Posner and Kevin Dooley and... Carl Potts and Mike Carlin and Tony Harris and... Bob Harris and Ralph Macchio and Tom DeFalco and...
Romita Sr.?
I was in Marvel Age.
Yeah, I was going to ask, how did that lead to the Marvel Age portfolio?
The Marvel Age portfolio was me doing my very best Art Adams... The long shot, a couple pages, and I remember getting a call from Kevin Lackey.
Oh, okay.
I think his name is. He still works. He's still an editor. And he called me. I was still a little kid. I was 16, so I was living at home, and I got a call. I'd mailed off a group of pages to those guys, and he called me up, and he said, "Hi, this is Kevin Lackey from Marvel, and we saw your sample pages, and we can't give you any work, but we want to run your stuff in Marvel Age, and we're going to send you $100."
As a 15, 16-year-old kid.
Yeah, and Romita Sr. is going to critique it for you. And I was like, holy shit. But I didn't, because when we first met, I was hanging out at the comic box.
Right. Yeah, that was a couple years later.
And
I was 18, 19, so it could have been just a couple
just
years later.
A few years later.
It had just hit.
And we would always call we would always call people lackeys, is like just to criticize them. And the guy, it was Kevin Lackey, I think his name is. And I was like, this is bullshit.
Yeah, this is not real. Paul or Reggie pulling
this is someone I know is screwing with me.
Yeah.
This is dumb. I'm not doing this. And I said, give me your number. Give me your phone number, and I'm going to call you back.
You're a cynical 15-year-old.
And if you answer the phone, and this is a New York number, then I'll give you all my information. And he was like, listen, kid. I'm
listen,
busy.
Kid.
I'm busy. And I'm like, look, Mr. Lackey. I don't believe anything you're telling me right now. And so he gave me the number. I called him back. And he's like, okay, give me your information. I was like, okay, I'm sorry. It's Thomas Coker, and my address is, I'm really sorry. I guess it's a, you know, it's like I've heard it all before.
That's funny. Were there any Sacramento comic pros who helped you out initially?
Kelly Jones was incredibly helpful.
Jim Sinclair, or is that a name I remember?
Jim Sinclair inked some stuff later on. But, I mean, the guys who really gave me a lot of...
Ron Lim, too.
Yeah, as I said, the guys who gave me a lot of direction, where they actually were really, really... that were pros, I mean, not just people I was working with. Kelly Jones gave me an enormous amount of advice, and Ron Lim gave me a lot of advice. And Tim Vigil gave me a lot of advice. Tim Vigil did Faust, like you were saying, which was just, he was the first guy I ever saw draw, like, the interior of a vagina. And I was like, oh, that's really well articulated.
Yeah. Okay, wow.
And back then, you'd still get, you know, good guys at shows, and you'd get, like, I remember meeting, you know, Starlin at one point. I remember meeting Starlin. He was really, really helpful, and I met Frank Sirocco at one point. He was really, really helpful, and it seems like the other thing about going to shows back then was that you could go, there were no celebrities. Like, it wasn't a celebrity, like, the artists weren't celebrities. I mean, they might be popular, but they were still sitting at a table.
Artist row and, like, a little psalm.
Everyone sat in Artist Alley, and you could just walk up and approach. I mean, I approached people that I should have never bothered with my crappy sample pages when I was 15 years old, and I would say, would you please look at this and give me input? And they were, I mean, with very few exceptions, they were all incredibly helpful, and you'd spend 3 days at a show and you'd get 150 critiques by people who all knew what they were doing, and I mean, that really, I think, impressed upon me, like, certain things that you had to figure out. Like, you had to learn, like, if your storytelling wasn't good and you had 150 people tell you that the same five things about the pages you're showing them suck, then you go, there must be something to this.
That's got to be legit, yeah.
Everyone's saying the same thing. No matter how much my mom likes it, I must be doing something wrong.
You're drawing pretty pictures, honey.
Yeah.
So, was Xenobrood your first commissioned work?
It was my first work for the big, two, Marvel DC. That was my first... Yeah, that was my first real job. I had done some job work for Kitchen Sink and stuff like that, you know, and some fanzine stuff prior to that. But that was my first real job, and it was... I feel bad. I should have never taken that job. I should have never said I could do it, because I just didn't realize I couldn't. Like, I thought, sure, I'll draw it. And then suddenly I'm drawing... I'm not just drawing monsters and superheroes fighting every page. I'm drawing...
Right, people talking.
Yeah. And lots of storytelling and lots of, like, and you can't just get bored and start over on something new every couple of pages. You know,
you've got a job.
This story, and I just didn't.
Yeah.
I was a kid. I was seven. I think I was I just turned 17 when I got that job.
It was probably very important. It's a learning experience because it's a real script. It was Doug Mensch who'd written thousands.
And Doug Mensch still hates me.
Really?
I saw him.
Just because you let him down on that.
I saw him like 10 years ago and he's like, "You're a jerk." And I was just like, "Oh man, I was trying to come up and apologize." And I did apologize and I totally get it. Like, I don't hold it against you that you think I'm an asshole.
17, dude.
And I said I was a child. I didn't know what I was doing. Yeah. And not only was I slow on that, but then right at the end of, I did 2.5 issues, I think. But right at the end of the second issue, Eric Larson approached me about doing a bunch of work for Image. And at the time, I was getting paid less than $100 a page by DC to do. I was getting paid less than $100 a page to do Xenobrood. And Eric Larson called me up and he said, "You know, I'll give you more than $500 a page to do the Vanguard book." And I was just like, "There's no,
yeah.
How do you? You can't say no to that. Like, no. you're just stuck. You can't."
Yeah. And so, in the middle of your Xenobrood work, you just bailed, or?
Well, I called up Kevin and I explained to him the situation, and he was like really upset, understandably. And I remember it turned into this big, like, "Please don't do this. Like, this is a 12-issue book. Like, this will really help establish you." You know,
Kevin Dooley?
Yeah, Kevin Dooley. And I said, "You know, I can't say no to this. Like, this is going to be..."
Yeah, it'll change your life.
And it did. I mean, it was, you know, the numbers on Vanguard weren't, like, numbers that people remember for Image, but at the time it sold...
Right, it was at the peak.
Hundreds of thousands of copies, uh-huh. And I saw an amount of money off of every issue from number one, and it afforded me to, after I did the couple things on Vanguard, it afforded me to take about 2 years off and just learn how to draw. And if I had done, I did do those first couple issues of Xenobrood, and suffice to say, they did not allow me to take a couple years off.
Right.
Like, the Vanguard book, the residuals on that and the page rate were enough on that I didn't have to work for 2 years.
And so we got almost serious about the band at that point. We had started a band,
yeah.
Or I had brought you in to join my band because I'd heard you sing and like, oh, okay. Like you tried out for our band doing an acapella, Oh Darling.
Oh Darling, Beatles, yeah.
And still my favorite song. I love that song. I should have danced to that song at my wedding instead of When You Wish Upon a Star.
I remember doing that audition though in the front yard of Mike's house.
Yeah, like, all right, this is easy. It's an easy choice. I'll gladly play rhythm guitar.
And I spent the whole time sitting there just fucking about and shooting the shit. And then at the very end, it was like, oh, I guess I should do this.
and then we went to Denny's.
Yeah,
and then he's in. He's one of us. It's pretty cool. I like that. I like when I bring people from different aspects of my life, because you were a guy that we hung out with at the comic shop, and then networked into a larger group of friends. Our band was, I don't know, I look back, I think we missed a lot of opportunities. We didn't know we could have gigged. We could have gone in.
We
didn't have very good gear. Songs were good, though.
We weren't smart.
Yeah.
I mean, we weren't... We didn't understand the idea of building a following and building a base and building
Just make a good demo tape and that's it. That's it.
Yeah. And that's all we focus on, just practicing and practicing and practicing. And then we'd always go record, like, I remember, I still have all the demos from some of that stuff. And like, we'd record, you get one shot at vocals.
Yeah.
And whatever didn't work, you're done with.
Yeah. Jerry said, "Oh, that's good enough."
Yeah.
That's fine. Jerry Jennings, I'm still friends with him. He and I are peers. We teach together at the same studio.
Oh, really?
Still, you know, 30 years, 25 years later.
I remember every time, like, going into the studio to record, it would be this situation where, like, you'd at a certain point, they're like, "Okay, your time's up." And you're just like, "Well, dude, we didn't finish anything."
Yeah.
They're like, "Well, your time's up."
It was all we could pay for.
And that's all you paid for. And so the songs would just be these kind of weird, malformed.
Yeah.
Half finished, no, you know, some of them wouldn't have leads, some of them wouldn't have, you know, backing vocals. Some didn't even have all the vocals because you were going to do something next, you know, change a bridge or middle eight or something. And That's a term I learned from the Beatles.
Yes.
And I still use it today. But it was fun, though. I think playing in that band was fun. The only regret I have about that band is that we were playing around the time that, like, the Counting Crows happened.
Uh-huh.
And that type of, like, sensitive, you know, sensitive guy all
Toad
rock.
Toad Rush Rocket.
You know, yet I love Toad Rush Rocket.
Too. I still do. I used to think, oh, we could be just like them.
I love those guys. I mean, that first record, those first two records are spectacular. Yeah. I've never even listened to anything after that. But I regret not figuring out a way to make this, because I think we did write good songs, but then we never took them to the next level where we figured out, like, okay, this is a lead and this is a hook and this is like a, it was always strumming and a lot of that kind of stuff. We never figured out, like, how to put together, we were doing Neil Young without the 35 years of Neil Young
right.
figuring out how to do that first. Mm-hmm. Like, it was like Neil Young had earned the right to just strum chords and just write beautiful songs.
And we didn't write riffs or anything.
We didn't write hooks. I mean, we wrote good songs, I think, but they weren't
good choruses.
Because I listen to a lot of, like, Simon and Garfunkel and stuff, and you can't get much more singer songwriter than that. And that guy wrote a riff and a hook for every song.
Yeah.
Every song started with a hook, a little guitar riff or something, and or a piano riff or something. And I lost sight of that, and then other guys in the bands just didn't. That wasn't their strong suit.
Yeah.
So they were great at putting together chords, but they didn't. That stuff didn't concern them.
Yeah, I know. And then I had started going to college and then got a waiter job. And so I was very tied to that. And I just didn't start. Natural selection had just kind of dropped out. I mean, they fired me, you know, and then brought in Brandon specifically, which is okay. I mean, that's, I would have done probably the same thing too.
I plead the fifth. I mean, I apologize for any kind of being an asshole or whatever, but I do remember, though, being like trying to figure out how to get to another level and not knowing why the fuck you couldn't get there.
Right.
And then not realizing until years later, like, oh, it's just that we just, as a band, we just didn't understand how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we were coming at it from the back ass words.
Yeah. We were reverse engineering it wrong.
Yes.
We'd look at songs, look at bands, like, okay, well, let's just write a song that's in that style or in that way. And it'll be done. We didn't develop things. We didn't. Yeah. And we did two records, basically. One record with me and one record with you. And then when I was done, you guys did some really good stuff, you know, I thought.
But even then, we never could finish anything. Because it was always, like, there's always this resistance to actually. Because I had always wanted to do stuff that was a little more aggressive.
And you were from a hardcore background, playing with bands like Deftones. And,
well, I didn't play with the Deftones, but I. In that type
your
of
peers,
thing.
Your peers. Yeah.
They were far, far and away, but those guys knew what they were doing from the very start.
Yeah.
But
they worked with, like, guys like promoters who would point them in directions.
Well, they were just good.
Yeah.
They just knew.
Absolutely.
They knew what the fuck they were doing from day one. Like, they had a sound and an approach that worked from the moment they started. And that's not true. They had a few years of bumbling around and figuring it out. But by the time anybody knew who the Deftones were, they were on their way to being what they are now. But then I wanted to do this more, like, aggressive stuff because of what I liked in music prior to all that stuff. And there was all the crazy stuff coming out, like all the Seattle stuff was happening at that point. And then there was there's a lot of amazing stuff coming out of New York, like all the Sonic Youth and, like, Dinosaur Jr. and all these different bands that were happening. And they were all really aggressive. And there was a lot of good punk stuff happening, like Fugazi and all this stuff. And
I remember Helmet broke big.
Oh, Helmet was great. Yeah. Tools happened right around there. I remember seeing them at the Cattle Club open for Far.
Really? That's been a weird show. I was never
Far
drawn
was relegated to the dustbin the moment the Tool opened.
Yeah.
They opened with War Pigs. And the moment that Maynard got on stage and he had that tattoo of his spine down his back and he sang War Pigs with his back to the crowd and all the lights were out. Far with the pretty hair and the pretty songs and the harmonies.
High voice, and Jonah's like, sing-songy voice.
They were
also South Sac.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were immediately irrelevant.
Yeah.
And I've never felt more bad for a band than seeing that band follow Tool.
That, yeah. I mean, at the same show, being blown away by your opener. Although Farr ended up having good careers. I mean, Jonah's done lots of stuff, and he still tours and writes. And
you know who I've always wanted to see again? They were so good. They were so, so good, was Kai Colm.
Uh-huh.
God, that was a good band.
Yeah, Kai Colm. And they played for years, and they still, you know, they're around in different
projects. And they had so many opportunities to go big, and they just wouldn't do it, and they wouldn't tour. And
they could have, too. They were that good. They were respected as, like, the best band in town.
Yeah, they were definitely the best band in, in that area, yeah. And they had that, and they were years before I'd ever heard of who Pearl Jam or Alice in Chains were, but they had that kind of, like, a really progressive sound that really would have fit well with that stuff, and they just, they were married and had kids and families and stuff.
Yeah, Gene
they just didn't
and Sherman
want to...
and they were dads. That band is still thought of. Like everybody I know in town, parents of students, and they were Kai Colm fans in town. Like that was their scene.
Do you know Mark Curry?
I know Mark's sister Brandy.
I know Brandy.
Yeah.
Tell me.
I will. Yeah, I know Mark and Tim. Is it Tim? No, what was Mark's brother?
Chris.
Chris Curry, that's it, yeah.
Chris was my friend from school, and then I met Brandy and Brandy's sister's
name. Yeah, I don't know the sister. I know Brandy just because she's still around. Okay, Brandy is still doing
she still has music
shows, and is good friends with my friend Leo.
And Mark was in a band called Crystal Sphere, I think, long time ago.
But he got signed as a solo.
And yeah, he was doing a lot of punk rock and doing a lot of this really crazy, weird like stuff. And then he went off and did a solo thing, which
happened about the weather, right? That was his.
But it happened right before. Like I can remember seeing a Mark Curry video on MTV that was preceded by a Bell Biv DeVoe video. So it happened just prior to the Seattle explosion.
Okay.
And Mark was an amazing singer songwriter. I worked with him as a dishwasher at a place called Jeremiah's Steakhouse. And he introduced me to James Addiction. He would sing these songs and he would sing his own songs, and he would sing, you know, a lot of old R&B and this stuff. And the guy could sing like nobody I've ever heard before.
You know, looking back, I can hear some of his influence in the way you would do some of the songs.
Yeah, because he was just a god to me when I was a kid. And then they did Sorry About the Weather, which I think they kind of tried to force him into like a Michael Penn kind of shoebox where... He should have just been allowed to be a dirty, messy, kind of scruffy. They shouldn't have cleaned him up.
Elliot Smith or somebody.
Yeah, he should have been much more like Elliot Smith or like, what's the great band that... I mean, he's got three records. Aeroplane Over the Sea is one, I think. Mm-hmm. Or one of the records is all about Anne Frank.
Really?
This guy developed this enormous crush on Anne Frank.
So he did a concept album about Anne Frank.
Anne Frank.
Right on.
It's a genius. It's genius. It's one of the best records I've ever listened to. If you can get past the guy's voice, they should have let Mark be one of those guys.
Yeah.
And but he came out in a moment when it was like, let's be Mr. Big or be...
Neutral Milk Hotel.
Neutral Milk Hotel, that's it.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'll
check it out.
I can give you...
I've got Spotify.
Oh, yeah. Man, if you can get past the singing...
Yeah.
Because the guy has a really high nasally voice, and he sings a lot.
Yeah, there are a lot of bands like that where you can get past the singing. I've been in bands where, you know,
I've been a singer at times when it's like, if you can get past the singing, it's okay. Yeah.
I know, Rush.
Baltimore! The Snow Dome! I love Rush. I saw them last year on their big farewell thing.
Yeah, I don't believe it. I don't believe they're done.
I don't know. I don't think Neil Peart tells stories. I think Neil Peart...
Yeah, it's true. He's serious. I mean,
he is a serious fucking guy.
And maybe there's just too much money to be made, though.
I think they've already made too much money, though. I don't think that's a concern of theirs anymore. But I remember those guys, I mean, all those bands out of Sacramento, there was a moment there was a lot of really good stuff. And then... And in hindsight, I realized looking at those guys, like Mark would sit there... We'd wash dishes together. And so we'd sit there for 6 or 7 or 8 hours. And I was working on the line and he was washing dishes or vice versa. And he was fearless. And he would just sit there at the top of his lungs practicing songs he'd written his entire shift. And you'd hear them over the course of a couple of days. You'd hear the songs change and evolve. And he'd write new words or change words or come up with a hook or come up with a chorus or whatever. And And I never... The bands I was in were always much more like whatever came out was what came out, and that's what you went with. And you didn't really develop it past that.
No, and we didn't have recording where you could really work on that stuff. We were... It was just rehearsal to rehearsal. And did you see the episode? I think it was an intervention with Mark Curry.
No.
I believe... I may be making this
I mean,
up,
I know that that happened. I know that...
I know that there was
he went down a dark...
Yeah. I mean, he was definitely a heroin guy from as long as... Or I heard stories back then.
Even when I knew him, I thought, this guy is artificially enhanced. Like, this guy is able to do... function at a level that you, a normal human being is not capable of.
There's a trade-off being made somewhere.
But then his brother, Chris Curry, the first time I ever played out, like really played out with a new band with Greg, we went to Café Montreal.
Yeah.
Where Doc Odd had that...
right.
Had that Tuesdays open mic thing or whatever.
I did those too, independently, eventually, and...
And Mark's brother, Chris, was playing there.
I played open mic at Capitol Garage with Chris Curry.
Chris is out of this world. Like, that guy can sing. He did Old Brown Shoe, I remember, by George Harrison from the Beatles. And my God, I was just... And he got, I think in the middle of one of this, I think after his second song, he had to hit the head or something. And so he asked if, we had been chatting earlier, and he asked if Greg and I wanted to come up and do a song just to finish out the set. And so we, Chris... He loaned Greg Chris's guitar, and we went up and did a song. And it went down, down a storm, as Rod Argent says in his talk about the zombies. But God, Chris Curry, that whole family. I mean, they're capable of doing things that I don't know how they do it. They seem fearless.
Yeah, Café Montreal became Café Paris, and then the original owners tried to open in Del Paso Heights, and that didn't go anywhere.
Yeah, we played there a couple times.
Dusty, right? I think. It's
yeah, Dusty.
Yeah.
We played there a couple times, and then Doc Odd just kind of faded away, I assume.
Yeah. Well, she had Club Can't Tell, where he was the booker for a long time.
We played there a handful of times, and then she did Capitol Garage.
Well, she's back to a he.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, and we can talk about this, acquaintances, and... she was in love with a girl. As a man, she was in love with a girl, but that girl was a lesbian. So she went. I was not quite transgender, but started affecting...
She started doing hormone therapy.
Yeah.
Stuff, I know that.
Yeah, and so that this girl could love her. And it was fucked up, because it was, you know, it was the kind of thing that would never happen. But I loved... Doc Odd had great songs.
Oh,
I
that
remember,
guy could write some... He could sing like
great
a son
songs.
Of a bitch.
Yeah.
And I remember I was a little skinny...
Dr. Velocity is the current moniker.
Oh, okay.
So,
I remember being like a little skinny 21-year-old or 22-year-old and hanging out with Doc Odd when he was a she.
Yeah.
Audrey. And
Audrey St. Violet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he would just...
Bo is the real name.
Oh, okay. I never knew that.
Yeah.
And he would just praise me to no end. And at the time, I was like, he must really like what we do. And I don't know if he was ever gay or not. I mean, if he had like attractions toward men or not. But in hindsight, I was like, oh, I was a little skinny.
Yeah, you did.
You were a twink in a band, and I had long hair, and I was this little cute, pretty little thing. And I would sit there and drink, just get hammered, and drink or eat soup at Café Montreal. Yeah. And in hindsight, I was like, oh, he might have been trying to ply me to because he booked us a lot.
Yeah. I remember I did a set, an open mic set with a couple originals, and then I did a Smashing Pumpkins song. And then this had to be 94, 95. I was out of your band, and then he talked about my set for a little bit. Like, you want to be a star? You could do this. You do this. Todd's working on it. And like, he was talking about me after I played.
Mm-hmm.
This is just regular open mic. Like, oh, okay. And then he segued into his set. Okay, cool. I get somebody who's actually listening.
That was what was great about it. That was what was great about Café Montreal in general, is that, and it never translated with Capitol Garage or Club Cantel or whatever.
But
Café Montreal, like, it had the open mic nights, but people really actually showed up to watch the open mic nights, and it'd be a full crowd. And I mean, I know Kay could come out of there recently, out of literally out of Café Montreal.
Anton Barbeau.
Anton Barbeau and a bunch of other stuff. So there was like this real like attention being placed on like these little weird acts, like what we were doing and other people were doing. People really came out to pay attention to it. And you could pack the place. I mean, if you got 20 people to come to your show, it was standing room only.
Yeah.
So it was like this really high energy place to play. I remember we would do Summertime from Porgy and Bess there. We would always... We did two covers. We did Summertime from Porgy and Bess, and we did Needle and the Damage Done.
That's right.
And we would end like the first half of our show with Needle. It was such a harrowing song to be live. It was so fun. It was so such a...
Greg nailed the part. He could play that very well.
And then we'd always... And it was a great song to come out of with something that was higher energy. Like, you could do this really, like, long, quiet ending and then go into something that was had a lot of pop to it. But then we would always end with Summertime, which was a big, fun song. And we did that one really well for some reason. And I remember people would go apeshit over Summertime or over, I don't know, Superstar, whatever the songs that we'd written. And it's still my favorite place to play.
Does not, it's now, I think it's the Golden Bear or something like that now. Yeah, that building is cool. That scene kind of replicated itself at the True Love. Did you ever go to the True Love Coffee House? Kevin Seconds,
I love Kevin.
Yeah, great guy. Oh my gosh. He's done a lot for my band, too.
A lot of bands. He's always been a guy who gave back. Yeah.
And so he and his wife opened a live music venue/coffee shop. That was great coffee, too. It was really, really a good scene. And then they lost their lease, and that they tried to redo it later, and it just kind of fell apart. So there's a vacuum. It just never was replicated. It was, restored after that was gone. Because True Love was a great place. My band was a sound guy there. My band, when I joined Warren, was Warren Bishop and the Holy Men. And we did very well there. Mm-hmm. It was just super supportive, and there was a scene of sack pop, what we call that.
Was Lon part of that?
Lon, I remember Lon earlier.
I loved that.
Yeah, more in the 90s. Yeah.
Yeah, they were a good band. They did the Carole King song, that I Feel the Earth.
Yeah.
It was like huge. Like, they did like this huge, like, Kiss Alive version of it that was just out of this world.
Did you ever see Weird Harold?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Weird Harold. They were great, too. That was nuts.
I saw a band play there. We played with them one time at a gig somewhere. I can't remember where it was at. And it wasn't the Press Club or anything. I can't remember what it was. But they were called Ed Special and the Nightmares. And they were like this... They were like a mix of the Pixies meets the Dead Milkmen. And with a lot of like hillbilly kind of like violin, like fiddle playing and stuff.
Were they from Nevada City or something? There was that kind of a scene... Where there was pop.
No, I think
Beatles
they were local, but they were just
Americana.
It was like punk rock Americana, basically. But they were huge Pixies fans, and they were huge Dead Milkmen fans, and they did this. We played a show with them, and afterwards, I was like, "Dude, you guys are you guys are on a different level. Like, you're writing music that that will never probably reach the masses because it's punk rock, but it's this music should be big." And they sent became friends, and he sent me a demo tape. But I still listen to it. It's in a cassette still. And I kind of covet it because I'm worried it's going to just like turn to dust.
You've got to find a way to convert that.
And
there are services around
here. I've always tried to find like where these guys went to, or if they ever did anything else, or if he ever went on to do more.
Who would know?
No, because his name was Ed. And I used to have the case he sent to me in because he wrote a big thing and put it inside the tape case and had addresses and like we would talk back and forth. But that's 20 years ago at this point, so I don't remember.
Did you ever play with Convoy or see that band?
No.
They were from San Diego, but they would play in Sacramento all the time. Press Club, Old Ironsides, and they had a Notorious Red cassette that was just great. And it was Americana. And what Mother Hips kind of became.
Yeah.
Mother Hips are still around. And although one of the guys is doing a band with his wife, that's actually taking off. So Nikki Bloom and the Gamblers.
Why do I know Nikki Bloom's name? Why do I know that name?
Her husband is Mother Hip.
Huh.
They might be Gramblers. I don't know. But anyway, so they have a they get these sponsorships and things like that. So you see them on YouTube.
Horton, I remember seeing Horton Heat and all those guys up there and seeing, I remember playing Malarkey's. I remember playing Old Ironsides. I remember playing the Cattle Club, yeah. Which I know whatever later happened to Jerry, but Jerry Perry
mm-hmm.
was not good. I mean, he got hurt in a bad way there, but.
Yeah, I mean, but he's still promoting. He's still out there. He's like number one advocate for Sacramento music, but.
But he always had that super pay-to-play version of playing, and it was always just a massive pain in the ass.
Yeah. Not as bad as the Boardwalk. The Boardwalk was the
ultimate. I remember playing the Boardwalk. God, I forgot all about the Boardwalk.
Boardwalk was an Orangevale rock club, and it definitely had more of a rock vibe, rock scene out there, metal.
Yeah.
You know, not as alternative and indie as
downtown,
that
was the thing.
Midtown.
Boardwalk was always like the antithesis of the Cattle Club.
And so, yeah, you have these two, not warring factions, but, you know, you had shows it that were this way, and then, yeah, I guess so. If you were fighting for local press or whatever. But.
Well, if you played the Boardwalk, you're more hair metal or something. Yeah. You're more like that kind of... Yeah. We never wanted to be that. We wanted to be Malarkey's and Cattle Club and Ironsides. And the Press Club, we never played the Press Club. That was where...
It was a bigger venue, too,
established
at that
bands
point. Yeah, it really was. It had pro sound, and there weren't a lot of pro sound clubs in town. Cool. So at what point did you get back into, like, did you go to... design and storyboards. I mean, you worked on Men in Black, right?
Did
you do the Men in Black figures?
No, Men in Black and Godzilla and I'm trying to think of the other ones that were around at that time. I started doing some design stuff here and there, and then I got into doing animation stuff, like for the cartoons for those shows. And then... And then I got back into doing mainly design stuff for a long time, and I would do an odd comic here and there. But
Like that Wolverine, you had that one kind of Wolverine issue out of nowhere, 77?
76.
Yeah, right after this huge selling. I can only imagine.
That book sold to the roof. Yeah. That book gave me a good amount of time to be able to keep figuring out what I was doing. But we did a lot. I did a lot of that stuff, and then the toy design stuff didn't come until. I guess the toy design stuff was all happening. Jeez, I can't remember how it worked now. That stuff, the toy design stuff really, really became like my main doing design and boards and all after Nightfall. After Nightfall, I was just like, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't understand comics.
it was such a huge crossover. It took years and years, it felt like. And then Kelly was very involved in that.
Yeah. But there was just this sense of, like, comics had become...
Death of Superman, too, but that was...
But they just become stupid. They'd become so artist-driven that the writing didn't matter, and I didn't want to draw, like, you know, TNA books, and I was trying to do something that was more illustrative or arty or whatever, and it just didn't... I didn't fit in at Vertigo, and I didn't fit in at Marvel... And, so it fuck. And so I just kind of just said, screw it, I don't want to do this anymore. And so I went off and did that stuff, and that stuff really did just save my career, I think, as far as, like, I didn't just quit drawing at a certain point. And so, and it was a good moment because those jobs were not all in-house yet or being shipped overseas yet. And so...
pretty much now everything is?
Everything's pretty much in-house or overseas, like a lot of Indian studios and a lot of Chinese studios and stuff like that. But I could still sit at home at that point and draw pictures basically using a fax machine.
Yeah.
And just fax things back and
work
forth.
Work from home. Well, did you ever share a studio with anybody at that point? You worked with Derek at all?
Robertson?
Yeah.
No, I met Derek and Jeff when I was a kid, and Shepard Hendricks and a few other guys from that crowd. And I still love all those guys. They were really... They were some of the most... it's not like we hung out every day, but we'd hang out a fair amount. We'd at shows. We always stayed, you know... in the same little circles and hung out all the time. But those guys showed me they gave me more positive. They were more, because we kind of became buddies for a time there. And I still talk to Jeff a lot. I haven't talked to Derek in a while, but they were able to be on it more honest about what I was doing than just getting a critique at a show. And so, and they were both working, like Jeff was doing Wonder Man and Derek was doing Justice League, Justice Society.
I think he was doing like Justice League Europe, I think.
Yeah, that's what it was.
And then eventually he got the Transmetropolitan.
Yeah.
With is that Warren Ellis? I think it is.
Transmets Warren Ellis.
Yeah, and you ended up working with Warren on Global Frequency.
He still badmouths me about
that. Oh my gosh, really? Oh.
I don't know why.
Huh.
I know why, but I don't know why. I don't know. We might want to cut this out.
Okay.
Yes, I did a Global Frequency with him that I really loved doing, and it was maybe probably the fastest book I ever did. I think he did like, I was doing, I think the last 4 or 5 days on that, I was doing like 3 pages a day.
Goodness gracious.
And that was pencils and inks and wash because the script was coming in spurts. But even though the script was coming in spurts, my deadline wasn't changing. So
it's not fair.
Well, I'm not, it's not a knock against him. And I think the reason he got kind of bent out of shape over the book was because he kept referencing NCIS or one of those type of shows.
Yeah, procedural.
Yeah, something where they would show like the book is one long fight sequence, and so in the fight you'd have somebody get like kicked and it would break their leg, right? And then he would want to do like a cut to X-ray image of like the femur shattering.
Yeah.
Or like a cross section of the of the body where you'd see like the intestines rupture. And I'm like, I don't know how you do
where
that.
Where do you
like
find that reference? Where do you?
But not even that. It's like, how do you draw a standalone cutaway image of an intestine and have the reader know what you just drew? Uh-huh. Like that doesn't. And Warren and I didn't speak to each other because he was, I think he was pretty swamped, so I never really had an opportunity. I think I emailed him once and he responded once, and that was about all we got. And so I talked to our editor, Scott Doonbeer, and Scott was like, just, you know, ignore that. Just skip over it. Because neither of us could figure out how to do it.
Right.
And,
yeah, that's what editors are supposed to do, help you.
And I think Warren thinks that I made a unilateral decision just to ignore what he was writing. Huh. Which it wasn't.
Yeah. That's unfortunate.
But I like the book. It's one of my favorite books I've ever done because it was so silly and ridiculous.
It was pretty over the top. It was a 12-issue mini.
Yeah.
And each issue had a slightly different theme and different artist, I think.
Brian Wood did the covers for them, right?
Brian Wood? The Vikings guy?
Didn't... Was it Brian Wood?
I'll have to look it up.
Shit, I don't know. He was a guy who started as an artist. He did the...
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, that's Brian Wood.
And then he became a
Northlanders.
Then he transitioned into being more of a writer. Mm-hmm. I think.
He ended up doing the Dark Horse Star Wars comics.
Yeah,
and now I have a book he does called Starve, which is really good.
Yeah, and he was one of the first guys that really started doing like the photo collage kind of like really heavy Photoshop.
Yeah, do you like Andrea Sorrentino? That artist?
I don't have any idea who that is.
Okay, did the Green Arrow, like really cool Green Arrow photo collage, black, very blacks, and now he does Old Man Logan.
Check
him out. Do you have Marvel Unlimited?
No.
Okay.
I don't read
many
books. You
don't have time to read, yeah.
I'm drawing the book I'm doing, so I don't ever have time to read. And I don't like... I mean, I look at certain people. Like, I really like Andy Kuhn's stuff. I think his work is genius, and I really like... Brian Huddleston, is that his name? Mm-hmm. Or... I know his last name is Huddleston. The guy's a genius. He's he can draw like just unlike anybody I've ever seen. But I don't read books because I don't want the outside input.
Yeah.
So when I'm working, I just
inform what you're working on.
Yeah, I just keep stacks. I mean, I literally have like 3 or 4 years worth of comics stacked up in my work closet that I just won't read because I just haven't had a moment to stop.
And waiting for your desert island time.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too. I have lots. I have boxes and boxes of things. Like, oh, that'll be a retirement project for me.
Yeah.
So many stupid comic books. Like, really? I used to think it was important to have a full run of everything.
The only thing I read that I would read religiously was Hellboy. No matter. And even when, I think Figueredo is one of the very best that's ever done this stuff. And I would read his books and I'm just like, God, I know this is going to screw up my day's work tomorrow because
like
this
stuff,
this work is so good and so, it's you can't compare what he does to anybody. And then you have Mike Mignola stuff, which is just like, I mean, his work is a pillar of what my work is based on. But for some reason I could still read those books and separate my work day from those books. But there are certain guys who I just can't look at their work while I'm working because it's too close to what I do. And I admire what they do so much that I just can't, I'll see it creep in, you know, and there are people that I emulated when I was younger, you know, like Sean Phillips or John Paul Leone and I are kind of peers, but he was successful a lot faster than I was. And so he was fully developed a lot faster than I was as a style. And so I can't look at John Paul stuff or Sean Phillips stuff when I'm working. It just derails me.
Yeah.
I'll find myself suddenly trying to figure out how to draw a picture with no border or no bounding lines of just shadows. And I'm like, wait, this is a John Paul Leone thing. I'm not supposed to do this.
Yeah. Jock is that way too. Have you seen his stuff?
Yeah, but it doesn't have the same effect on me. Like I like what Jock does. But by the time Jock would have an influence on me, I had already stopped looking at a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I can still look at a lot of, there's like a lot of Italian guys and a lot of French guys I can look at still because they're different enough that I can look at them for, I don't know, input or if I'm trying to figure out how to do something. A lot of those guys have really good solutions, but it doesn't, there's certain American guys that I just can't look at their work without it just... John Romita Jr., I can't look at his work, even though I don't draw anything like John Romita Jr. I just look at his work is so powerful that it's like, God, I can't, why can't I do this? Yeah. Like, my figures never look this big.
It's interesting how refined he's gotten over the years. I really like, I think his DC stuff, actually. You know,
it's beautiful.
Yeah, he's doing Batman coming up, and I'm just like, in the sense of the Dark Knight things.
Really? His work I love, speaking of Batman and DC, is Greg Capullo.
Yeah.
That guy's
evolved so much.
Man, he's a beast.
He's got an Image book coming out in a couple months, too, so which I'm happy for him because he deserves. I mean, I'm sure he made lots of money on Batman, but
his
art came so far from his Spawn things, even his X-Force stuff.
But, I mean, he did Spawn, though, for...
Yeah, years.
The difference between his first Spawns and his last Spawns are you wouldn't think they're the same person.
No. And just the design work the layout work he's done for the Batman, the Snyder Batman.
It's beautiful.
It's so amazing. And, you know, there's that issue that you have to turn it around as you're reading it. It's so cool. Yeah. Capullo is definitely somebody I'm happy for because he's just worked and been consistent for so long, but he's gotten better and better. And now hopefully he'll get some creator ownership stuff happening.
Well, he's always seemed to be a really good guy.
Yeah.
I don't know him in any real sense. Like, I don't ever talk to him or email or anything, but like when I've met him at shows on occasion here and there, and he's always been like a really outgoing, really good with fans, really swell guy.
Yeah. You don't hang with him at the Artists Only bar?
Where?
Yeah, no, there is no secret fraternity of comic book artists.
There used to be, but there's not anymore.
Yeah.
I don't know. I was just talking
about our other artists, contemporary artists. So we should tie this up. We have a couple things I want to remember or go over. So I had been out of the band, but we were still friends, and you had been kind of exiled from DC. After Xenobrood, but you invited me to a DC Christmas
staff party.
Oh, I was
still getting invites to the Christmas party.
And you were probably still on the comp list, too.
I was.
Yeah.
I gave you a lot of that shit.
I did. I ended up, I still have a lot of that, like Kyle Baker stuff.
And, yeah.
Why did you give me Kyle Baker stuff? You should have kept it.
It's really good. I think I had all of it already.
Okay, that probably makes sense.
Like, it's the same with the Sandman stuff, and I had all that stuff, so I didn't... Yeah, it was like, I'm getting it all after I paid for it. Yeah. Like, fuck!
You got me into Sandman, because we went to a con and talked to Kelly, and I just, well, it's pretty cool. I'll buy something from this guy, and I didn't read Sandman from the beginning. I bought it from Kelly, the third trade, the Season of Mists, and like Kelly said, just read it. You can get into it. And then I was huge.
Brilliant.
Oh, man. Because it's
out of this world.
It's unbelievable. Just the all the different references and things you are inspired to read about after reading Sandman. And
that was one of the greatest things about that book is how it drove you to look at other stuff.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, just the research Gaiman did on that, and he had it all up there. And he's still adding on to the world. He just did that prequel series.
That was beautiful.
Is that Williams? J.W. Williams?
Yeah. That guy is another guy that I'm just... I can look at his work, but his work is just... It's really breathtaking.
That first Batwoman run he did, so good, so cool.
J.H. Williams.
J.H. Williams, that's it. Yeah, at the third. Yeah, The Sandman is beautiful, but you know it's nice that you can go back and tell those stories again. But one time, I had just gotten into Sandman, and you were still—I think you were working on it on Vanguard.
Wait, do the Christmas party before you do phone call. I know where you're going with this.
So the Christmas party was actually chronologically later.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was like Christmas in '93 or '94.
Okay, so I guess do the other one first.
Okay, so you were still at the old studio in South Sac, and you know. You have editors and things like that, and I don't know what it was, because I knew how much you idolized Gaiman and enjoyed Sandman and held it up to a different level. So I don't know. We were all in the process of ribbing. Our band was all about practical jokes on each other, and busting balls, calling each other nicknames, and you know there was affection, but man, there was sometimes
it
a
was
little
brutal.
Bit of cruelty.
It was it bordered on tears a lot.
Yeah,
like those where you're like, I'm going to the bathroom now.
How many times he added Mike? Shut off his bass and fuck you all.
Fuck you all.
And he should have been the one to handle it the best. He was this big bully, this big baby Huey guy, you know?
I remember making Alan pissed. I mean, and Alan doesn't get pissed easy.
No, he's the most resilient of us all, but he's the one who's always on the attack.
Yeah, but I've seen Alan get, like, defensive, like his feelings get hurt. Like, cause you're fucking with his, like, the fact that he, you know, couldn't get a drum fill right 100 times in a row. And, fuck you.
And we'd give him Shopette because he worked on Mather, and he worked at the little convenience store, so it was called the Shopette, so that was my nickname.
The
BX. Well, there's the Base Exchange, where I ended up getting a job eventually, which didn't pay. I made more at the gas station. I went from a gas station making, I don't know, $2.50 a week to part-time at the base making $175 a week. I mean, $50 a week is a huge difference when you're trying to make bills. And I was stuck in a lease, and my roommate had bailed at that point.
That guy was such a prick.
Yeah.
I remember that dude. Yeah. What was his name? He had a hot little girlfriend, but
prick. He's ironically, he lives in Hollywood Hills.
I remember we would always...
his name is Reeves.
Yeah, and we would always... Yeah. I never, ever watched an episode of 90210, but we would end up at your apartment every week.
We watched Melrose, too. We watched 90210
and Melrose. Yeah. And I would always just be like, this is so stupid. And so I would, like, go play guitar or something.
And he was just the scene, you know? Yeah. Like, all these beautiful girls and high fashion and stuff like that, you know? Narcissistic stuff.
He lives in the hills?
Huh. What? No? It was
he lives in the
been,
hills now, though?
Yeah, he does. He does. He went to Cuba, too. You know, he's just... Yeah, I, you know, love him. Friends, but obviously can never trust him again, and we'll never be close friends again. But every time I hang with him, we have a good time. But
so we did all these practical jokes to each other, and I idolized Sandman and Neil Gaiman as being the be all end all of comics.
And so I thought it would be funny to
Wait, let me tell it, because it's better if you tell it from my side.
Yeah, that's true.
I come back to the studio one night and it's late, and I had missed a phone call, and so I played the message back. And I get a message from Neil Gaiman saying, you know, in a chippy little British accent that, hi, Tom, and I like your stuff, and I saw some work from whatever you're doing at DC at the time. And I want to know if you'd be interested in doing any Sandman stuff in the future or coming up or something like that. And I was
exiled, like you said, from DC at that point, and really trying to figure out what I was doing. And this was like this godsend moment where I had this guy that was absolute top of the pops at the moment with Neil Gaiman asking me to do some work. And he leaves this message. And then I don't remember if the phone number was garbled or if he just got cut off and didn't do it. I can't remember how.
I don't know. Maybe he said, I'll call you back
or something. And so I heard this message and there was no response. I mean, there was no way to contact him back. And so I knew Kelly Jones, who...
Oh, my God, you followed through on it.
Who worked with Neil for years. And it was like 10:30, 11 o'clock at night or something like that. And I was like, fuck it. I'm calling Kelly right now. And I got off... I finished listening to the message. I got on the phone. I called Kelly at 11 o'clock at night or 11:30, whatever it was. And I was like, Kelly, look, this is what's going on. I just got this message from Neil Gaiman. And this is what he said, and like all I need his number because he didn't leave a number, or the number was cut off or something. And so I need to get a hold of him. I'd like to call him back tonight if you can give me a call and give me the number. And I think Kelly was working on Batman at that time.
Yeah, but, Nightfall covers
and I was just like
Red Rain eventually
jumping out of my skin. I was so excited and happy, and like just thought the world had just opened up in front of me. Like I was suddenly everything was going to be good. And then Todd called me about 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later, right?
I think I did. I did follow up on it.
And I related to Todd that I just got this call from Neil Gaiman and that I'd called Kelly and left a message. And then Todd said,
"Hello, Tom. This isn't really Neil Gaiman. Pip, pip, cheerio." I'm so sorry.
I was like, oh my God.
You've been...
How could I not have understood that that was a fake Neil Gaiman call? Well, and how did I just call this guy Kelly Jones that I thought could help me get a hold of him? He must think I'm an idiot. And he's probably talking to Neil right now going like, you didn't call this guy, did you? There's no way you called this guy. And I never heard back from Kelly on that. And so I assume he just either ignored it or... Right. Realized that what I was saying wasn't true, and and so I wanted to crawl into a hole for
a
few days there. No, it was a totally fair game.
That's what we did.
It was 100%.
It is what we used
to do. It's funny in the past.
It is. It's unfortunate.
Or in past tense, it's funny.
Yeah.
And so then after that, a while after that.
Yeah, I mean, you just called me out of blue, and you had... plus one to go to the DC staff West Coast Christmas party.
Yeah, in the Bay Area, in San Francisco.
San Francisco, in a hotel in San Francisco in the city. And we went out to dinner first with Eric Larson and was it your agent or was it a girl who was putting together an agency for comic stars?
Sharon Cho? No.
I think she's Asian, but...
Sharon Cho, I think.
I think so, out of Berkeley. Nice dinner, it was a good time. And then went to the party, and it's like this who's who of DC luminaries.
It was awesome. They used to have these Christmas parties where you'd go and it would be, they'd send out an editorial group and a group of artists like from wherever just to kind of make sure there was a population at the party to begin with.
Right. I remember we went up in the elevator with Norm Breyfogle.
Norm Breyfogle, yeah.
Oh, super nice guy. Yeah, and Luke McDonald, too, I think, was there, too.
And they had Archie Goodwin was there.
Yeah, that was the one that was like really... Denny O'Neill was
Denny
there.
Denny O'Neill was there. God, those guys are good guys.
Mike Archie Carlin.
And Denny. Mike God, Carlin
I got to
there.
Talk to Mike Carlin about Superman was currently dead at that point. You know, I got to talk shop with him about the death of Superman.
He was the meanest person I ever met at a show. He, not to derail from this,
no,
maybe a couple years after that, I had run into him in a show and I was showing him my portfolio and ties into John Paul Leon where I showed him a bunch of pages, and they were, you know, I was doing a lot of blacks in my work and shadowy stuff. And I looked through the pages, and he's kind of like, and he's flipping through them too fast. I know he doesn't like it because he's going too quickly through the pages. And he said, "Look, Tom, if we need a Mignola hack, I'll just call John Paul Leon." And I was like, whoa.
Wow.
Like, you didn't only just devastate what I'm doing,
no,
but you threw in John Paul, you threw John Paul Leon under the bus just to make an asshole point.
Yeah.
But, Neil Posner was at that
Get
together. Jill Thompson was Jill there?
I don't know that Jill was there. Trina Robbins was there, I think.
Oh, Trina Robbins. And
Dick Giordano and his wife. And it was like they were kind of the hosts, it felt like.
Yeah, they were Denny and Archie were kind of always the Al Gordon was there. He was a funny son of a bitch.
Yeah, great guy, great inker for Jerry Ordway.
Yeah.
He's a big dude. I remember that.
Yeah, big old school,
older, tough guy than everybody. You know, kind of
old
like,
school guy. And
so it was neat because that was my first like, whoa! I've met pros at cons before, but not like the Justice, not the Justice League, the E Street Band, basically.
Well, and you have like the open bar.
Yeah.
And you have the people walking around with trays of food. I mean, it was really like an old school.
I was underdressed. I remember.
Me
that.
Too. Yeah. Me too. And I remember, but it was like a very old school. It was something I don't think people in our business do anymore. It was a professional attempt to make the people, the freelance people community that worked for you feel like they were part of a bigger, a bigger cause or like they were part of a family. And Marvel did them too, and I think now they just basically have shows and they have cons and they have a party at a con, and that's supposed to make you feel the same way. But it's never the same because at the Christmas parties, I think it went to 3 or 4. It was always like they were just doing it to do it. You didn't have to go to a show first. You didn't have to be bummed out and sweaty and tired from being at a convention all day. You would just go to the bay and you get an invite and you go to the show.
Yeah. Oh, it was so special, and it like you know DC signage and things up. It was really cool.
I remember, hanging out with Archie Goodwin and Denny O'Neill. It's just like you're sitting there and you're sort of talking to these two guys that have done. Their careers before and after that were more impressive and defined this industry in a way that. Almost nobody has done.
Right.
Maybe Jim Lee and a few other guys have had that same kind of impact since, but Archie was just like, and Denny, I know Archie better than I know Dennis O'Neill, but those guys defined DC Comics for decades.
In retrospect, I think Archie may have been fighting cancer at that point too.
I think it might've been in remission.
Okay.
At that point.
Wow.
And then, yeah, because I saw him at a show like the year before he stopped doing any appearances, and I wanted to cry. I was just like, oh, this guy, he's such a good guy. He didn't have any reason to be friendly to me or know who I was. He always remembered your name.
It's like his baseline.
He was always on top of what you were up to. If you were, on his radar, he kept tabs on stuff. And he's just this really amazingly old school guy that just doesn't seem to exist in the business anymore.
Should have talked to Crisis or something with him, or Who's Who, or just all these things that he worked on. But I was just more, it was just personal level. We were talking just, how are you? Okay. What do you like?
Yeah. I love being in the Bay Area. San Francisco is beautiful. I love the fog. We were at Alcatraz yesterday. Have you tried the sourdough? I mean, it's like really just shooting the shit kind of stuff. I mean, the two people I've worked with since, I was going to say Ralph Macchio, but he's of that generation.
Yeah.
I mean, he's like the guys who came out of that generation, so he's very much in that same vein. But like Axel Alonso and Tom Brevoort, who I think is almost of that generation.
Mm-hmm. Axel definitely.
But Axel's new. I mean, Axel's newer generation. I think Tom Brevoort's kind of like a bridge in there. But those guys are the only two I've worked with that I've felt like, and Axel more so because I worked with Axel more, that really felt like they had that same kind of magic touch that Archie and Denny O'Neill had. Mm-hmm. I mean, they had this ability to...
Yeah, you don't hear about editors too much anymore as far as... If they're any good at editors...
There's no Jim Shooter.
They go up. They end up at the corporate job of some sort of administrative job.
Yeah, like Axel. Like, I can't do a book with Axel ever again because he's not that level anymore.
Yeah. It's tough because, he's an old school guy. Now, Marvel has been called out on diversity, on Twitter and things like that. It's fanboy rage and...
Called out because they have too much diversity?
No, because they did have there's no black characters here. There's no female lead characters here.
Isn't Iron Man a young black girl?
There's definitely been a very conscious thing over the last year or so
to make that happen. I mean, Ta-Nehisi Coates on Black Panther is a huge step. Speaking of which, you did a Black Panther issue? Or
I did a short story a long time ago.
Huh? Who wrote that?
I think the person you just said, Priest, right?
Yeah, Christopher Priest. Yeah. He's just coming back to comics, which is cool. He'd been out for a while. Yeah, I remember that. It was kind of a random issue. I think I have 5 copies of that, though.
I think it was like 7 or 8 page story in the back of an annual or something like that.
No, it was a sequential story. It was a numbered story. It was in the series because I was reading it pretty
religiously. It's part of Marvel Knights.
Yeah. Yes. Which is Axel, right?
Jimmy and Joe. And I think Axel was...
I remember...
I never dealt with Editor at all. It was Jimmy that I dealt with entirely.
Really?
Yeah.
Are you friends with Jimmy currently?
I think Jimmy's a great person.
My friend Stephanie is like just the biggest Jimmy and Amanda fan. Like everything is...
Never had any dealings with Amanda because they never really had any reason to. But yeah. Jimmy and I, he inked a bunch of stuff I did back when I was working for Penthouse and Omni Magazine.
That's right. You did some of that stuff.
Living Gods and stuff like that. And I just always thought he was like the greatest inker in the world.
Mm-hmm. He was just a good writer too. His Jonah Hex stuff. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I did those Monolith books for him and I was going to... There was a point where they were doing the collections and I was going to go back and change Batman into a different character so they could reprint those issues.
Uh-huh.
And then my dad had a stroke and some stuff happened with my mom. And so I couldn't do it. And I still regret not having had a chance. But I don't think I don't know if they ever actually did finally reprint those three or if they had someone else change it or I haven't spoken to Jimmy.
So it was stuff you did for Penthouse that you wrote, redrew Batman into?
No, I did a Monolith. I did 3 issues of Monolith, the book they did with the creator-owned book they did with DC.
Okay.
I think it was like the first creator-owned book that actually interacted with the DCU.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I did 3 issues where Batman and Bruce Wayne showed up.
Right. Busiek did a book like that too, Power Company.
Yeah. And so they, when the book ended, they got the rights to it back. So I think they did 12 or 15 or 20 issues or something like that.
That's funny. Yeah.
They have to remove Batman if they want to reprint those 3 I did. And those 3 I did have a really big reveal at the end of the 3rd issue that relates to the main character. And I remember they asked me to go back and to change Batman out to somebody else. And I could never.
Yeah.
I remember in the midst of dealing with the health stuff my parents were going through, I would look at the pages and just be like, dude, I drew these 15 years ago. Like, I don't even know how to draw like this anymore. Like, this is so foreign and strange. And I didn't, I just never, I couldn't wrap my head around how to change everything and not just have to redraw all of it, you know? Mm. And also, I don't have the originals. And so they were sending me like, colored and lettered scans. And I'm just like,
how do you work around that?
How do I do this? This doesn't make any fucking sense.
How do you paste over the bat ears, the cowl? What could you do? I don't know. Just turn them into a void.
I think they gave me an idea of a guy who was like a crab man or something. Something silly. And it was just like, I don't have any idea what you're asking me to do. I'm so confused.
Find some kind of public domain character or something. But cool. Well, we should wrap this up.
We've gone on 4 hours.
That's all right. We've covered a lot of bases. It's been an awesome talk. So thank you for making time.
And I think once you edit this down to like 15 minutes, it's going to really haul ass. It'll be great.
No, I am going to leave. Not awards and all. There will be that stuff about the
just
hookers.
Cut up the helicopters and you're going to take out like 45 minutes.
So cool. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk to you again.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Touch the distant lands, exotic spices and colorful women with exaggerated insults, knowing that all that bring me back were encrusted golden idols in the shape of bleeding hearts, but nothing of the land. Give me back my filthy rags. In Mediterranean moonlight, we are whole, no, so tired. love this silly game. What's up means nothing anymore. Just marbles and plastic bubbles stolen from the earth and carried home, home in bloody hands. So I ask of you, my enamel, idols and worn out gods, what's become of my blue landscape? It's vanished from these pictures, leaving only what is sad. And I am speaking to you, do you hear? I'm asking nicely, take nothing of this land. Give me back my filthy rags. A Mediterranean moonlight. We are whole, no, so tired. Know this silly game. What's up means nothing anymore. Just marbles and plastic bubbles stolen from the earth and carried home. Home in bloody hands. Filthy rags and Mediterranean moonlight. We are whole, no, so tired. Know this silly game. What's up means nothing anymore. Just marbles and plastic bubbles stolen from the earth and carried home. Home in bloody hands. Home in bloody hands.